This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. State lawmakers and attorneys general are scrambling to preserve reproductive rights in the wake of a leaked draft of a Supreme Court opinion to overturn the Roe versus Wade precedent. But those who are paying close attention predicted the end of Roe months ago. And now they're warning that the far right will not even be satisfied with banning all abortions. My guest, Michelle Goodwin, writing in The Nation, says, quote, the anti-choice movement has succeeded at quietly criminalizing pregnancy to levels not previously seen, making it so that to be pregnant and poor in this country is to play a game of roulette with one's privacy and constitutional rights. These criminalization efforts make it clear that the fight doesn't stop at abortion. Michelle Goodwin holds the Chancellor's Professorship at the University of California, Irvine. She's a contributor to The Nation and also host and executive producer of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin and founder and director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy and its Reproductive Justice Initiative. She's the author of several books, including Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. It's such a pleasure to have you on our program, Michelle, after many years. Thank you so much for joining us.
It is a pleasure to be back with you. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show.
So this idea of criminalization at the heart of how abortion is going to be, or the abortion ban that that the Christian right wants will be enforced, is at the heart of it. And of course, it seems to go very well in the hand in hand with a tough on crime approach that has, of course, a white supremacist agenda that has targeted people of color. How do you see the police state intersecting with abortion bans, not just at the state level, but very soon, unfortunately, at the federal level?
Thank you so much for that question. The criminalization associated with pregnancy is something that we've seen before. So what's happening in the United States is the revisiting of the most arcane, inhumane, and undignified laws being targeted at girls, women, and people who have the capacity to become pregnant. And these criminal laws existed immediately before Roe v. Wade. The court struck down laws that were criminalizing abortion, most directly targeting doctors as a means of scaring them and threatening them with the removal of their licenses and also with incarceration for helping a girl or a woman be able to safely terminate a pregnancy, ultimately leading to girls and women seeking myriad other ways to terminate pregnancies, many of which were just simply dangerous, taking a coat hanger to your uterus or asking a friend to do it is dangerous, but this is something that a girl or a woman could be compelled to do in circumstances where they simply do not want to be and cannot afford to be pregnant. States now are threatening various forms of criminalization associated with pregnancy terminations. The threats against doctors performing abortions, threats against individuals who want abortions and then seek them or want to use self-medication in order to achieve the termination of a pregnancy. We're going to see the kinds of criminalization, because it's already been threatened, of people going out of state to terminate a pregnancy, or people helping women and girls who want to go out of state in order to be able to terminate a pregnancy. And I think that what we need to think about is not just how we sort of keep up, but what it is that we can predict. We've been in this space that's given far too much legitimacy in terms of humanity to people who've shown that they cared nothing and have no sense of regard for the lives of poor people, poor women of color. And so there's been this sense for the last several hundred years in our country, which has been wait and see. Clearly it won't be that bad, but we're coming from a space in which indigenous people were marched off their lands in the Trail of Tears. A nation in which there was legalized human bondage, the legalization of kidnapping people, sex trafficking them, labor trafficking them, a nation in which, and then there's nothing of any kind of pride to say in this, right? A nation that even after the abolition of slavery found myriad ways of trapping people into Jim Crow realities that tracked every aspect of their lives, from education to going into parks, to recreation, to housing, to try to dehumanize and denigrate and degrade Black people who had come out of slavery. And so then in the space where folks are like, you know, well, they're not going to do it, let's wait and see. Well, you know, actually, if we actually look at what these histories portend that there are any number of things that we cannot only just kind of think might happen. Instead, we can understand the kinds of things that will happen. And this is not to be doomsday about this. We are already within the dooms of the day. And let me shed a little bit of light on that. We're already in the dooms of the day when we have in the state of Mississippi, 80% of the cardiac deaths during pregnancy are Black women. We're already in a doomsday when the United States ranks 55th in the world in terms of maternal mortality, where the United States cannot group itself amongst what it calls its peer nations, such as Germany or France or Sweden or England, but instead in the territory of Russia and Bosnia and Saudi Arabia, in terms of just how much it does very little to protect women and girls who actually are pregnant. We're already in a doomsday where Black women are 3.5 times more likely than their white counterparts to die carrying a pregnancy to term in the United States. And that figure only multiplies when we look at states like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas, where those disparities in terms of rate of death in certain counties just multiplies beyond that figure. So as we look at the potential for what will happen, let me just close that question with saying what we've already seen. So we saw in Mississippi, Renee Gibbs, 16 years old, charged with depraved heart murder, Black girl, for having a stillbirth. We saw Regina McKnight, the first person in the country to be charged for murder for having a stillbirth, a young Black woman who had been a farm worker who had experienced dramatic traumas in her life, including her mother's death, and who informed her doctors that she had self-medicated in the wake of all of that trauma, and her doctors releasing that private patient information to law enforcement. We saw in the state of South Carolina, the medical university there engage in a conspiracy with police and prosecutors to encourage Black women to get care for prenatal care, and then specifically coordinating with police and prosecutors to turn over private patient information in the cases of the Black women who came in for prenatal care, leading to the arrests of dozens of Black women, women who were dragged out of the hospital in bloodied gowns and shackles and chains, had no idea why, had no idea that their doctors and nurses were complicit in a scheme to turn over their private patient information. We're talking about Bebe Shui in Indiana, who was charged with first degree murder because she was pregnant and attempted suicide. So given that we already see right in our rearview mirror, in very recent rearview mirror, the kinds of instances that I've just talked about, it already lays the path for, in many ways, what might be part of the playbook that goes forward.
So there's the issue of pregnant people being very soon unable to, and in some states already unable to access abortion. But then if there are pregnant people who want to keep their pregnancy but miscarry, unfortunately, could face criminalization. There's also the issue of terminating pregnancy chemically through pills, through abortion pills, which, you know, a lot of abortion advocates pivoted to thinking, okay, well, they can't take that away from us, but they are working to take even that away from women and birth control. And there's even talk in some places, bizarrely, of banning condoms.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So in work that I've done, including the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. But in prior Law Review articles, I write about how part of this very well-funded anti-abortion movement, it's not that it is a large movement, it is that it is a very well-oiled and funded movement that has very deep ties and connections to nationalism, xenophobia, to movements that were adamantly opposed to Brown v. Board of Education. That is when the Supreme Court struck down discriminatory segregation laws that barred Black students from being able to attend the schools in their neighborhood and thus be educated sometimes with white students. There was a movement that was adamantly opposed to that. And so despite what was recently shared in the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, that there were people who came to respect the decision or comply with the decision in Brown v. Board of Education, well, that's absolutely not true. And history records that. We saw the attacks on Black students. We saw what the attempted integration of the school in Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, just how mobs of people came out and said, let's pick which one of those Black students, only nine of them, let's pick one of the nine so that we can lynch, right? So we're talking about these kinds of histories. And given this kind of toxic mixture between the movements that have been white supremacist and nationalist in our country, and their ties then to the anti-abortion movement, it goes deep in terms of what it is that they're looking to prohibit, right? So it, as you mentioned, it's not then just about abortion. It's also about contraception as well. And it's also about how, in fact, to reach those people who can help in this agenda. So for example, part of this movement has funded campaigns to reach pharmacists. Are you a pharmacist whose interest align with an anti-abortion, anti-contraception platform? Well, if you are, we will provide legal counsel for you if you refuse to provide contraception to people who are coming in to get the prescription filled. And so there's already been this kind of movement afoot where people who are pharmacists have received various kinds of communications encouraging them not to fill prescriptions for birth control, not to fill prescriptions for Plan B. Plan B is not an abortifacient. Plan B, what it does is it helps to prevent a pregnancy from taking place, and it's used after intercourse. And it is the gold standard that's supposed to be recommended to people who've been raped. And it's really shocking and quite horrific that there have been cases in the United States now where women have shown up to get Plan B after being raped and encountering pharmacists who've refused to fill those prescriptions. And that's part of also this backdrop that we must pay attention to.
So we know that when white wealthy women get pregnant and do not want to be pregnant, that they will find ways to access safe abortions. What is your prediction for who will be the primary victims of this criminalization? It's going to be low-income women of color and trans people, right?
What an important question that you ask, and you always ask excellent questions, Sonali. But yes, we've seen this playbook before. We know that even after Roe v. Wade, a very important decision by the United States Supreme Court in 1973, a 7-2 opinion, so it's very clear, 5 of those 7 justices, you know, were Republican appointed. And it's just really clear that we level set in that regard so that people understand that what we're talking about is not just everyday politics and that, or that this is a position that Republicans have always taken. It's not. And so when we think about who's going to be harmed, even after Roe v. Wade, we saw with the Hyde Amendment, which bars federal dollars from being used for people who are poor to be able to terminate a pregnancy. We saw the Supreme Court uphold challenges to that. And so there's the disenfranchisement that poor people of color, poor women, poor girls of color, you know, poor people generally being disenfranchised from access, right? So if you think about it, you know, we're kind of in the space of a new version of an underground railroad. You know, there'll be people who won't have to go underground because they'll be able to fly to and drive their Teslas to the states where they need to terminate their pregnancies or get there by their Toyotas or whatever means it is. But when we're talking about the most vulnerable in our society, these are going to be the people who are shut out. And what's most alarming about it is that, you know, we're talking about states where there are already high rates of death associated with pregnancy. And so when we add on the layer of coercing people to remain pregnant in a backdrop where they die in those states, one can't help but think about this as a death sentence. And I say that to ring the alarm bell, but I say it not as an alarmist. That's just the reality of the data that comes from those states. You know, sometimes I'm asked, well, what leads me to this impression? And I say, I don't have to be led to the impression. It's the data that's coming out of Governor Abbott's state that tells us exactly why it's been called the deadliest state in the developed world for a woman to be pregnant. I don't have to guess this. It's the state that comes from Mississippi's Department of Health and Human Services that collects this data that tells us that Black women have an inordinate rate of death when they're pregnant in that state. And so you raise a really important question about who gets disenfranchised, and with that, who quite frankly dies as a result of these kinds of policies.
And then, Michelle, there was a time when we would look at countries like El Salvador and other nations in Latin America where abortion was banned and where women were being criminalized if they had miscarriages. You know, Amnesty International would rally behind these women. There would be campaigns here in the United States to support them. Here we are right here in the United States facing this reality ourselves. What can we learn about how to push back? You mentioned earlier the movement to ban abortion, which is part of the movement to criminalize, you know, pregnancy in low-income women of color, is not a very large movement. They're a small minority. Abortion and the right to abortion remains very popular in the United States. So short of ensure Democrats retain control of the of the House and Senate, and the pregnancy and the presidency, which they have in the past, and they've not used that moment to codify abortion rights into law, short of electoral means to pushing back, what do you think we can learn from other countries, even countries like Poland, here in the United States, to oppose this very dangerous state of affairs?
Well, I think there's a lot to be learned by social movements. I think that there's a lot to be learned in this country, right? So as I've been calling this the new Jane Crow, building upon that such important legacy of Pauli Murray, who 80 years ago used the terminology of Jane Crow to describe the intersectional experiences, the bombardment of what it meant to be discriminated against when you happen to be of color, when you happen to be a Black person, when you happen to be a Black woman, and she was also queer, right? All of these together helped her to conceptualize that it's not just Jim Crow that was necessary that we pay attention to, but also Jane Crow and what these experiences meant in terms of a very specific kind of discrimination that occurs when there is the confluence of identities. And I think in learning from Jane Crow and learning from Jim Crow, social movements really do matter. It matters what information we share. It matters that the narrative is not controlled just by the people who dominate news cycles, not your news cycle, but mainstream news cycles. I mean, if you think about it, Sonali, if we left this sort of conceptualization of who people of color happen to be, it would be that the narrative would be if you were indigenous, you were savage. If you were Black, you were unfit to even be called a human being. You were just simply property, lacking intelligence, lacking morality, and with hypersexuality. If we left these narratives to describe people who are Latinx, women of color who are, you know, Latinx women of color have been typically described in hypersexualized terms. And we could go on and on in terms of, you know, what these sad narratives have been. And so what we saw during the sort of civil rights movement of fighting back was this rearticulation, right? And so there's the need for rearticulation, there's the need for social movements, there's the need for demand and reform with regard to voting, because we can't really talk about voting without paying attention to voter suppression. And the fact that there have been such significant gerrymandering of the vote, and also the dismantling of voting protections by this United States Supreme Court. And then there's on the ground work. It's important to support those who are actually doing the work, who are providing the kinds of services and the help that people need. And again, if you think about the civil rights movement, where there were people who were coming from northern states to help and advocate for folks who were in Mississippi, who were in Louisiana, who were in all of these states. They needed food, they needed transportation, they needed resources to help them be able to do that work. You know, Freedom Summer doesn't happen, or movements to get people registered to vote doesn't happen if you don't provide the core essential support that people need in order to just sustain themselves while they're doing this important advocacy. And the last thing that I'll say, and there's much more that we could be said about this, is that it's important that we remember that this kind of advocacy is about our democracy. It's important that we understand it's about the rule of law. When we see these kinds of attacks on voting rights, these kind of attacks on reproductive health and liberty, these are core attacks on fundamental liberties. You say something about a democracy that is backsliding, not a democracy that is robust, that is trusting of its populations, that cares about the people entrusted within that democracy. It says something very different.
Michelle, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your website as well as a new piece that you wrote in The Nation magazine. Thank you so much, as always, for your insight.
Thank you.
My guest is Michelle Goodwin. She holds the Chancellor's Professorship at the University of California, Irvine, and is a contributor to The Nation. She's also host and executive producer of the podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin, and she is the author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.